Hi, this is Jane Garvey. Thank you for downloading Monday morning's edition of the Woman's Hour podcast. We're talking about Zoella in a moment or two on the programme. Also today, how do you stop re-offending? Maybe a charity called Key for Life is onto something. I'll talk to its founder on the programme today. We'll discuss a festival exploring the female voice in religion and an interview I think you're going to enjoy. A New York psychoanalyst has finally got round to writing the book she's always meant to write. It's called Scary Old Sex, and she has some stories. On the serial this week, in a contrast to Fear of Flying, it's a new dramatisation of Jane Eyre. Oh, sighs of relief across the nation. Plates can be washed to the accompaniment of Jane Eyre this week. That's if you're at home, of course. If you're in the office, you can listen and enjoy as well. Now, Zoella, she's about 25 years of age. She has 10 million YouTube subscribers, over 7 million followers on Instagram, about 4 million on Twitter, and the author of the book Girl Online, recently voted the most popular title by secondary school children. In other words, we've got to face the fact she's much more important to our teenage daughters than we are, or possibly ever will be. And she's Alfie Days' girlfriend. Now do you understand what I'm talking about? We're going to discuss the phenomenon that is Zoella with Chloe Hamilton, who writes for The Independent. Good morning to you, Chloe.
Good morning.
And also here, Judith Woods, who has two young daughters and writes for The Telegraph, where she's a columnist. Judith, welcome again. Good to see you. Good morning. Some people listening will know exactly who Zoella is, who Zoe Sugg is, but if you have absolutely no idea, here's just a little taster.
Hello everybody, today I am going to do a makeup tutorial for you. I'm going to attempt to do it because, as you know, I am no expert. I have been really loving a kind of dark berry lip at the moment, as you may have seen from my second channel where I've been vlogging every day. I've been wearing it quite a lot recently. I'm going to start off with a little bit of concealer.
So here I am, facially naked on the internet. Something that quite honestly terrifies me. Although I know that not everyone has perfect skin, I'm quite insecure about mine as I've inherited dark under eye circles. Yay! Thanks, Dad. And I also get scarring whenever I have a spot, which tends to leave me with a few blemishes and a little bit of redness. Just pinning up my hair here so it doesn't flop into my face.
That's just a few examples of the phenomenon that is Zoe Sugg, Zoella, as your daughters will almost certainly know her. What are we to make of all this then? Judith Woods, you have interviewed Zoella. We've tried to interview Zoella and she's not been terribly keen. You spoke to her a couple of years ago, didn't you?
I did. I went to see her in Brighton Hove where she lived. I think she still does, because you can tell where she lives because there are loads of little girls outside waiting for her, like the paparazzi, but much more terrifying. I went to see her at the behest of my daughter, who was then about 10, 11, because she was like so famous and she was like so nice and she'd really like interview her. So I went along thoroughly expecting to dislike her. And I didn't.
Because?
Because she was everything I wanted from a highly influential vlogger. She doesn't drink, she doesn't swear, she dresses like an upmarket florist's assistant, she doesn't have tattoos.
And she never will get one, apparently.
She never will get one.
No.
And she's just a very nice girl who does what she does very well.
So why do some people object to her then? Because this is a programme that tries to celebrate women and their achievements. Here is a young woman who has done phenomenally well. She's bright, she's got, I think, 3 A-levels, all grade A. She's a good thing and we ought to all love her and enjoy what she does. So why don't some people?
I think vloggers and the whole online social media sphere is very alien to us as adults. Even someone who's 28 might not quite get it. And we're always looking for signs of moral turpitude because in previous generations, you know, the Rolling Stones were a bit crazy, or Rihanna shaked her tush, or Miley Cyrus twerked. And so we're very cautious about this mass hysteria towards an individual. We're, as adults, looking for the reason, because it seems too good to be true that our daughters could be in thrall to a very nice girl who at 25 likes to wash her guinea pigs.
Yeah, she does have guinea pigs, and I can't remember their names, but they're quite significant, aren't they? Oh dear, I've fallen at the first hurdle in my Zoella A levels. I haven't got very far at all. Chloe, can you help me out? Do you know the names of them?
I don't know the names, I'm afraid. Sorry,
but they certainly feature. They have a special environment in which they frolic, especially structured. So you wrote an article that was a little bit critical of Zoella, and her fans were not happy.
They weren't happy. No, my article was sort of based on the fact that I feel uncomfortable with the fact that Zoella's contributing to a sort of beauty culture that I find troubling. I think there's a chance that, well, I don't think that 10-year-old, 11-year-old girls should be told how to contour their faces or put smoky eyeliner on. I actually think that they should be taught that looks are not important, and that it is, you know, it sounds cliche, but it is what's on the inside that counts. And the way that Zoella has sort of launched her career is in telling young girls how they should look, and I find that uncomfortable.
That's not all she talks about, though.
No, she has done some good work in mental health, and I would not want to begrudge her
that. Just explain what she's done there.
She talks about her anxiety, and she's an ambassador for Mind, which is great. You know, that's fantastic, and if she raises awareness in that way, that's really good. However, I'm still troubled by the fact that she, on the one hand, tells girls they shouldn't worry about the way they look, and on the other hand, tells them how to put the perfect, you know, lip on.
Yes.
I think that's a bit contradictory, and her stance is a little bit hollow.
What do you know about her relationship with the manufacturers of all this stuff?
I know that she has a beauty sort of line out with Superdrug. She has her own line. So she makes money on selling, you know, makeup to children, and at the same time telling them how they should put it on.
Right. She wouldn't endorse a product she didn't think worked, presumably.
No, she probably wouldn't mention it because she's Zoella. Quite some time ago, vloggers started fessing up to whenever they got freebies. So they will say outright online, "I got this sent to me," or "I bought this," to make clear the divisions between product placement and actual buying. Mm. And I do understand theoretically this idea that somehow she is perpetrating a dolly appearance and this kind of put on makeup and you feel brilliant or not. But truth be told, we've been through this with Barbies, and it's not down to Zoella that she's watched by 9 and 10 year olds. It's just that 13 year olds have outgrown her. And I can remember when I had daughters, I was never going to give them a Barbie because it was peddling the wrong kind of female stereotypes. And then, you know, I just lightened up.
But I think that Barbie has changed recently, and they've, you know, launched lots of different shapes of women. Like, Barbie are progressing, and actually Zoella sort of isn't really. I think she's still perpetrating this myth that women, young girls, have to look a certain way. You know, we should teach children, young girls and young boys, that it's not the way you look, it's who you are that matters, it's what's on the in. It's so important that we teach them it's what is on the inside that counts, and we're not teaching them that. And
right.
I was all, yes.
I mean, I'm interested, Girl Online, the fact that Zoe's book, Girl Online, is now officially, the most popular book voted most popular book by secondary school pupils. Now, that would be, you don't have to be a literary snob, I don't think, to be slightly concerned by this, Judith. I know Zoe herself has said she didn't write it. She was hugely helped by a ghostwriter. But what do you think about the book?
Again, I'm sorry to be such a Zoella apologist, but frankly, anything that gets girls reading these days is to be applauded, because unfortunately girls have gone the way of boys, where their obsession with online is such that they would rather absorb information from a screen than a book. It's quite unusual to get so many girls reading the same book. I think we're all taking this far too seriously, to be honest. I think because she's a pioneer of her generation in how she has gone from a girl in front of a shaky camera to someone who is polished and appears and does meeting and greeting and has her own makeup line, we are frightened of that power. But the truth is, we've already seen a generation growing out of her. My 13-year-old has grown out of her.
But
my 7-year-old will grow into
her. How young her fan base is, and how important it is that we sort of, I mean, how scary it is that 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds are.
Yeah, I think that's a good point from Chloe, to be honest.
Yes, I suppose it's, I think scary is overdoing it. I think girls will always experiment with makeup. Mm. And the truth is, makeup has become something which is much more prevalent among younger people. It's not just a case of people nicking it from Woolworths as they did in my day. Your first makeup was nicked from Woolworths. That's probably why it went out of business eventually.
But No, I was just going to say that by their very nature, vlogs are edited versions of reality. They're rose-tinted versions of someone's life because they are put together in a certain way. And I think that young girls, people who are watching them, will always strive for that level of perfection that Zoella portrays, and it's unattainable because it's not real.
Well, that is predicated on the idea that they watch it constantly. And well, if any parent who has got any investment in their daughter's self-worth will not allow her to watch it constantly, it becomes one shade in a palette of media experiences and voices that they hear. And so Zoella they go to for makeup, Zoella they go to if they're feeling a bit low because Zoella's felt pressure. Zoella actually, when you watch her, you do get a sense of her as a person. It's not just an Instagram, here's my curated life, here's my curated face. We've seen her cry on screen, which I thought was to her credit.
Right, OK. Well, clearly two very differing opinions. Chloe and Judith, thank you very much. Theodora says, I was 10 in the 60s. We were so desperate to try makeup, we used watercolours on our eyes. It's just something that happens. And from another tweeter, I have a 10-year-old who adores Zoella. Yes, it's important we teach what's on the inside. I think Zoe is harmless popular culture. She does these shopping hauls where she goes out and buys loads of stuff. She's not the only one who does these. And I think there should be a middle-aged version of this where I can go and reveal that I've bought some, I don't know, some deep heat and some fairy liquid. I can imagine that people would be absolutely desperate to watch that. Thank you both very much for coming in. Any thoughts on Zoe or Zoella? Let us know what you think at BBC Women's Hour, or you can email the programme on our website, via our website. Now, David Cameron made a speech earlier this month about plans to tackle high levels of reoffending and reform of the prison system. There are apparently going to be league tables to show how good jails are at cutting reoffending and getting inmates into work. Now, this is going to be music to the ears of Eva Hamilton, the founder of the charity Key for Life, who is already working to do just that. This organisation gets mentors to work directly with young men before they come out of young offenders' institutions. And it also, crucially, and this is interesting, involves their mothers in getting their lives back on track. So we'll hear from Eva in a moment or two after you've listened to Charmaine and her son Anton. Now, he got a 3-year sentence.
Everyone that's in this cycle of offending, it's like they're all trying to find their way out. We all are, you know what I'm saying? So I felt like this programme, this charity was a way out for me, you know what I'm saying? In fact, I was doing other things. I was doing a drama class in education while I was in the prison, and it got heard of that I was really onto my music and stuff, and they got a music side to the charity. So my name was flying around in the prison, and they actually come and approach me and got me allocated to the programme.
And what did you do? You say the programme, but what does that mean?
They come every week or every 2 weeks, depending on what stage in the programme we're at. Mm-hmm. So that could be music, that could be football, you know, that could be helping you find a job or something like that. There's this intense attendance to our needs and everyone coming together and creating a bond first before we push forward together. And then when it starts to get a bit more comfortable, that's when everyone gets allocated to a mentor. You know, we start talking about what we're going to do when we get out, because as much as it's in prison, there's also working towards what we're going to do when we're on the outside. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's building relationships and that trust, you know what I'm saying? And just pushing forward together.
So do you have one person that you see regularly, or is it a mix of people?
There's a mix of people, but everyone has got their individual one mentor. But
you have to get on with these people, presumably.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What if you don't like them?
If you don't like them, it can always be changed, but right. I wouldn't think that would be the case, because everyone is just so down to earth, you know, everyone's there to be helping you, you know what I'm saying?
So what did they offer you that no other charity, organisation or individual had ever offered you before?
It's not so much what they offer, it's their personal contact, the way everyone is together. It's more helping you find yourself and helping you on your journey, you know. First, coming to find a journey if you haven't got a journey, you know, helping you get grasped with what you want in your life and helping you on that journey. I've not seen nothing like it before. Like, there's organisations, say, for instance, like probation. They're meant to be hands-on, making sure they know everything, you know what I'm saying? And it's nothing of the sort. I could ring my probation officer and ask him, could you, just to test the waters, could you get me into work? How long would you be able to do it? And he wouldn't know a clue of it, you know what I'm saying? And if he did, everything changes along the line, you know what I'm saying? But with Key for Life, you get what you're given, like your everything's met, your requirements are met, you know what I'm saying? If you wanted to do something, they can tell you where they can meet you on achieving that.
And were they, I mean, when you came out of prison, were they waiting for you? Were they outside?
They was not outside the prison, but they got in contact with me the first day. And 3 days after that, we went off to Somerset. Eva, the founder of the whole programme, you know, she... This is why I said the trust levels is just so high, because, like, we're in her own house in Somerset, you know what I'm saying? She's brought us all to her house, you know, like ex-offenders, you know what I'm saying? And
what are you saying, that you wouldn't do that?
Precisely, yeah. Okay. You know, that's just the trust levels, you know what I'm saying?
And okay.
It's crazy, but, yeah, she's...
She's had quite an impact, hasn't she?
Yeah, okay. It's inspirational.
Right, well, that's good. I mean, and Charmaine, how do you think it's changed your relationship with Anton? Because certainly bringing up teenagers, I know you're a single mum, you've got other kids as well. They're a little bit older now, I appreciate, in their 20s, but not easy. And how have the charity helped you or changed your relationship, do you think?
It's enabled Anton to see life from a more positive perspective and given him the hope that he can achieve and not feel that everyone's against him or there's going to be stumbling blocks put in his way to prevent him from getting to where he wants to get to, because the system can be like that.
When he was going off the rails, as he did, as you'd appreciate, what could you do to help him or to intervene to try to get him back on track? Or was it difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, I had five children. He's the youngest. He's one of a twin. He's got a twin sister. And it was very difficult because Anton, his hurt was so deep. And regardless of the attention that you give, it's that missing person that he's yearning for, and nobody can compensate for that.
Are you talking about his dad?
Or, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes it was hard to reach him emotionally to, you know, really get him to open up. Sometimes he would just go off into his quiet state or he would go missing sometimes, you know, because we're talking about from when he was like 9 years old coming up. But I think that through his whole experience and reaching to the stage where he is now since he's come out and he's been working with Key for Life, I think they've had such a positive impact on him because they've given him that encouragement and they're working side by side with him every step of the way, and they keep in contact with me as well. They let me know what's going on and, you know, I can support him as well in what he's doing with them and just encourage him, you know, with his talents. I know he's extremely gifted, you know, he's always had that, but it's even more enhanced now because of the opportunity that they're giving him.
Well, tell us, Anton, where are you at now in your life? What are you doing?
Well, like, it's crazy because Key for Life is not just a charity, you know. They open doors for you to places you wouldn't even dream of going to, you know what I'm saying? For instance, when I first came out of prison, I was doing a job trial in the Willis building, suited and booted, you know. I wouldn't have thought me, coming from the background I've come from and the area...
What were you doing there?
Insurance, right. You know, like I was just learning bits and bobs, but the good thing about it is everyone is working at a different level, so there's people that have worked there for years and they're still learning. It was good. It was a great experience, I have to say, it's moreish. You want to know more.
Yeah,
you know
okay.
what I'm saying?
So were you surprised by how interested you became in that?
Yeah, I was okay. surprised. And I've actually been told I can go back there whenever I want. And I cut hair. I got a self-employed barber in, like, I'll come to your house, cut your hair, home visits mm-hmm. and stuff.
Yeah.
I wasn't only on the programme. I'm now mentoring on the programme. So the prison I've come out of, I've been going back there and paying visits and helping the next lot through the programme and, you know, just showing them living proof that it works.
When you speak to the lads who are still in prison or about to come out,
yeah.
Can you see yourself in them? Do they remind you
yeah,
of how you used to be?
I was in jail for 2 years, 8 months. Sometimes I'll be talking and we'll be having a conversation. I kind of drift off because it's like, oh, I was sitting here. Now I can actually leave, you know what I'm saying?
You can walk out.
Not only that, it puts a smile on my face because I can actually show them the journey that I've been on and know that they can follow me on that journey.
And they, presumably, they look at you and see what
yeah, I'm doing. They see it. They see it, that it's working.
I just want to ask your mum a bit about the atmosphere at home now compared to how it was maybe four years ago, let's say, 5 years ago maybe. Tell me, what's the difference?
It's quite peaceful. It's really peaceful and it's very musical.
Right.
Because they're always Craig, like he's got an older brother and he does music as well. I do music. And his twin sister, she does music.
Have you got tolerant neighbours?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope.
But, I mean, the walls are padded, obviously. Yeah, they're always creating music, so it's a very musical environment and you can hear them kind of working things out and working together, which is really nice. And everybody's just kind of vibing off of each other.
Charmaine and Anton. Eva Hamilton is here, the founder of Key for Life. Eva, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You certainly seem to have really made a difference to that particular family. But why is it the job of your charity to do that? And why, as Anton drew our attention to in that conversation, is the probation service not able or willing to do more?
Well, I think the difficulty is it's really the focus that we spend a lot of time looking at is the pre-release before the young men leave prison and then the post-release. I think probably looking at it, it's the joined-up approach that simply doesn't exist at the moment, which is where a lot of young men find it very challenging, both before they leave prison, to prepare themselves to come out, get a job, unlock the pain that they've got, which is what we spend a lot of time focusing on in the early days, is trying to unlock those poor behaviours that have got them into trouble. And then most importantly, equipping them with the skills for work. And when they come out, helping them, show them there's a new path. And I think probation struggle to be able to provide that sort of consistent support that we are able to give them.
Because they don't have the expertise or they lack the resources? What
I think it's probably both.
OK, but David Cameron made that big showcase speech a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. He seems very serious about this. What advice would you give the government then?
Well, I think they need to look very carefully at what is working. And I think rehabilitation has to be, as he said, and we absolutely applaud what he said, at the centre of it. So we would say that they need to look very carefully while these young men are in prison and they've got them in prison and they can work on them. It's not just about education. Education is extremely important, but they need to be looking at the other areas of rehabilitation. And I think when they come out, there needs to be a joined up approach to give these young men a lot more support and women when they come out in terms of accommodation. Many of them have mental health problems, learning problems. We've heard about absent fathers. That's a major challenge for a lot of our young men.
The statistics are extraordinary about absent fathers,
appalling,
aren't they?
Appalling.
What is the figure of the number?
It's over 70% of our young men haven't got a father present.
Right. Have never had a father present
in their lives. And most of in my first cohort of young men, which I ran my first programme down in Bristol in 2012, I would have said there was only two young men from Bournemouth that had fathers, and the other 21 had, there was no father present.
Well, they all
present.
Had fathers, but they just
they
didn't
had
have...
No, they did, exactly, they yeah, all I mean, fathers, this is, yeah, but they didn't have fathers present in their lives at the moment.
Right, and you'll sense that there is a frustration, to say the least, at this, because this is appears to be a bit of a perennial problem that doesn't seem to go away.
I think it's a huge problem. I think the problem when I go and see these mothers, and my team does, you know, they're wonderful people. They're often trying to hold the show together. They might have several other children. In Anton's case, his mother's got five children. And for me, I suppose it's the support that these mothers need. that, you know, the mother is trying to provide, they're trying to be the provider, they're being the father and the mother, which is very difficult. And then the son, in many cases, is the eldest son that we work with. Then they take on the responsibility of the surrogate father to the other children. And then they go out and maybe get involved with crime, drop out of school.
Because they feel the need to provide
exactly.
for the unit. Right,
exactly.
OK, I mean, so far you have not, I mean, by your own admission, you've not been able to help that many young men. How many have been through the programme?
Well, at the moment we've got 82 people, but we've got two new programmes currently going on. We've completed with 46. So it's early stages, but I spent the first 3 years really developing the model and working with my team and other partners to get the model. It's seven steps. It's a seven-step model, getting that absolutely right. And our, you know, reoffending rate is extraordinary. We're less than 18% after 2 years versus the government,
that's
which is
still
74%.
Based on the relatively small number of young
absolutely.
Men you've helped, that is still some people who nevertheless went back in.
Yeah, we've got a very small, on our current cohort that have come out of the prison in London, we've got one on remand at the moment after a year, and that's it, which is fantastic.
OK, but why can't some individuals be helped, do you think?
I think some of them, when they come out, if they haven't made that decision that they want to change, that's the biggest thing is you can bring a horse to water and make it drink, but if they're not prepared to change and they're still prepared to hang out with those people that have got them into trouble, it won't be long, just often by just association, that they'll find themselves back in trouble.
Well, I suppose unless life offers them something
else. A new path. And that's what we're very much about. Lots of ours now have got work. You know, three quarters of them are into employment now, and we've still got over half of them in jobs, which is fantastic.
Now, I know you've had a career in the charity sector,
yes,
haven't you? I mean,
yes.
This is why, presumably, young offenders institutions were prepared to listen to you and
yes.
be involved with your work. Just explain to the listeners what other stuff you've done.
Well, I was very fortunate when I was 22, I helped set up the Prince of Wales's Seeing as Believing programme, which took business leaders out into the inner cities. I then set up the Ready for Work programme, which helped the homeless get back into employment, which through Marks and Spencer and other companies we rolled out to 23 cities, and that's still going very strong. And then my last charity I set up was the Warrior Programme for soldiers, predominantly soldiers coming back from war-torn zones with post-traumatic stress, and that was very much another model, and I've kind of combined all the models to put into this particular model that I'm running now for Key for Life.
Right, well, it'll be really interesting to keep an eye on what you're up to and how it's going. Thank you
Super.
Very much.
Thank Eva. You so much. Thank
That's,
you.
That's Eva Hamilton, and the charity is called Key for Life, and earlier you heard from Charmaine and her son, Anton. Now, tomorrow on the programme, Jess Glynn is going to perform live, which I'm really looking forward to. She has a magnificent set of pipes and she's live on Woman's Earth tomorrow. And on Wednesday, Are You Turning Into Your Mother? That'll be an interesting discussion. If you want to take part, email via the website, on Twitter at BBC Woman's Hour. And the podcast is available. It doesn't cost you anything to subscribe. bbc.co.uk/radio4/Woman's Hour. Now, the Sacred Voices Festival at the London Jewish Cultural Centre, the JW3, starts on Thursday. It says it's all about special events, workshops and performances celebrating the female voice. Now, cynics at this point might interrupt and say that religion doesn't always allow women to have a voice at all. Lindsay Simmons is with us, Orthodox Jewish academic. Lindsay, welcome to the programme. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Humaira Khan, a Muslim activist, is here as well. You're both taking part in Sacred Voices. So let's start with then the idea, Lindsay, that frankly, patriarchal religions, and I'm including Christianity, have always tried to keep women quiet. What do you say to that?
Well, there's several things to say. The first thing to say is, of course, biblical narrative records many women's voices. They are given to us as role models and examples of where women have had something to say and we need to hear it. When you move from biblical narrative to Talmudic narrative, rabbinic narrative, those women's voices are much more limited. Interestingly, in a contemporary setting, you'll find there's newspapers that don't even mention names of women. So you can see the stark difference between what was all right for God and what's okay for the current ultra-Orthodox community.
So in the 21st century, there are newspapers that do not mention women's names.
Correct.
Because?
I guess because they think there's something immodest about it. This is an extreme perspective,
yes,
and it is not commonplace or mainstream. But nevertheless, those perspectives are present, and I think that's important to think
right.
about.
Humaira, why did you want to take part in this festival?
Well, as The organisation I'm part of, Anissa Society, has been around 30 years now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we always felt very important about is that as women, we have a contribution, a role. We have something that we draw from our essence as women and a particular perspective. And so, therefore, we've always been involved in the idea of women's voices being heard, but not necessarily always on a soapbox. It's about women and what they do, women, how they engage, and women challenging in different ways. And so it's always been important for us.
But within the Islamic community, how easy is it for women to challenge behaviours and indeed traditions?
You know, it's actually not as difficult as mainstream media implies.
Well, go on.
I can only tell you from experience, because I've been involved in doing that for donkey's years.
Yes, yeah.
And the thing is that there's certain rules that apply if you really want to impact change. Of course, if you want to confront and challenge, where there's a place for that too. You know, often it becomes like, you know, a battle. But if you really want to, you know, shift the action and the behaviour of people, you have to be a little bit more circumspect
and patient, I would imagine.
Well, I'm going to quote something which I'm sure most of your listeners will find horrendous, is to say, my mum always used to say, you know, if you really want to influence men, you've got to give them a good meal. And, you know, I argued
well,
with her.
Right.
I argued with her throughout my teenage and 20s with that, but I'm beginning to see the wisdom of it.
Are you?
Yes, okay. Because you have to, you know, you have to soften up the lamb before the slaughter, really.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's quite a thought, isn't it? I hope our vegetarian listeners aren't too upset by that. So what is this? I mean, are you speaking at the festival? What are you going to be saying, Mary?
Well, I'm going to sort of re-look at the term of sacred and what do we mean by that. And I'm going to look at four key areas of that. Which will be sacredness as women, let's say, in our relationship to God, sacredness in places, the role that women have had in what we consider to be our sacred places, like the Kaaba, the Mecca, and other places, sacredness in our actions, and sacredness through our cultural activity.
But I'm interested in the fact that I don't think you want a women-only mosque, do you?
Personally, I understand the thinking behind it, but I would rather not go down that road, because a mosque by definition is a place of worship and a place of congregation. And if we then are creating women-only spaces, then aren't we creating the opposite problem to the men?
Right. You're nodding, Lindsay. What do you think of that?
Well, that's an interesting thought about whether women have to have their own sacred space in order to have a voice, or whether their voice ought to be heard in the community in general. I mean, I think one of the issues, my particular interest in this event will be also to talk about specific things, education, women's voices in education, women's voices in ritual participation. But specifically, I'm interested in women's voices in leadership and authority. And I think when you go down the women-only route, which certainly works for ritual participation specifically, I think there's a lessening of authority and power within the community in general. If men have historically spoken for both men and women, why is it that women only speak for or to women?
Women, yes, that's interesting.
I think their voices need to be heard across the community.
Right. I mean, are there people within your faith, Lindsay, who would rather you pipe down?
Yes. That's the short answer.
Well, there we are. Thank you very much for coming in.
No, but in general, I mean, there are always a multitude of eclectic voices in any community, religious or otherwise. There are those who I have fabulous conversations with and who can hear an alternative perspective. The question is that always the case? There are, I've had examples of where I've been asked to speak at, say, a particular community on, say, an upcoming festival. And I've been told that I cannot speak about this, that and the other because that is not my remit. Specifically, I was told I couldn't speak about the legal issues of particular religious rulings. And I did respond and say, look, I will be speaking about that. If you don't want me, that's fine. But I won't be told what I can and cannot speak about.
Who was it who told you couldn't?
It was a particular rabbi who I went. It was a man. It was a man, yes.
Isn't that extraordinary? What a coincidence. Just a good guess, I think, on my part. So how far away are we, Humaira, from female imams?
There needs to be a definition of imam, first of all, to answer that question. I won't have time to go into that today. But I think if you are talking about women's wisdoms, women's theological wisdoms, women's scriptural wisdom, there definitely are a phenomenal amount of women that you can find today who are actually emerging and having a voice and having a say and putting their stamp on the theological discussion. I think what we'll see is, as time goes on, that these voices will become much more integrated, and that's what I really hope will happen.
Okay, well, you're both speaking at this festival, aren't you, which starts this week. You're not speaking together, you're separate.
No, we're on a panel.
You're on a panel, okay. Well, it'll be worth hearing, I'm sure. The Sacred Voices Festival, if you want to know more about that, there are details on the website. Thank you both very much for coming in. Really enjoyed talking to you this morning.
Thank you.
That is Lindsay Simmons and Humaira Khan. Thank you. Now, if you want to get your collection of short stories noticed, one way might be to call it Scary Old Sex. It certainly worked for our next guest, Arlene Heyman. Arlene, if you move a little bit nearer the microphone, that would be great. You wanted to be a writer all your life, but then you sort of strayed into psychoanalysis. What were you thinking of?
I was trying to decide whether I should get a PhD in literature and earn my living that way while writing. But I was in psychoanalysis. It helped me greatly, psychoanalysis, okay, in my 20s. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do this. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll become a social worker. And I decided I wouldn't make enough money. I wouldn't have enough power. That was how I was thinking in those days. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll get a PhD in psychology, because I'm really I was not a science person at all. I took one course on rats, actually, and I thought, no, I don't want to be studying this. And then one day my analyst said, in response to my saying, God, at this rate, I'll end up becoming a physician. And he said, why not?
Well, that's what happened. But I want people to listen to the power of your writing. So here you are reading an extract from the book Scary Old Sex. No, it's not called Scary Old Sex. Yes, it is. What am I talking about? This story is called
The Love... It's too frightening a title.
I'm certainly petrified of it. Yeah. This story is called The Loves of Her Life. And it features Marianne and Stu. Here we go.
It didn't sound like much, making love once a week. She had made love 3 or 4 times a week with her first husband, who'd been younger than she and who had died 11 years ago. But now that she was 65 and Stu 70, spontaneity was difficult. She had acid reflux and so had to stay upright for 2 or 3 hours after a meal, or else suffer burning pains in her chest. And she had to insert Vagifem, low-level estrogen tablets, in her vagina twice a week so her tissues didn't thin out. He used Viagra 30 minutes before sex, and because he tended to come too soon if they weren't making love often, and once a week wasn't often, he also took a dose of clomipramine, an antidepressant that had as a side effect retarded ejaculation. The Viagra made him feel flushed for the rest of the day, and the clomipramine made him spacey. So they usually had sex toward evening, if not at night.
That is an extract from that story. And if people listening in their 20s are thinking that won't happen to me, well, it will, won't it? It's just a question of time. Just thinking there is spontaneity is a wonderful thing, and it's something people take for granted perhaps earlier in their life. So tell me...
But this is also just this couple.
Yes, just this couple. I know. Perhaps they're not entirely typical. So the whole time you weren't writing, did you want to be a writer? Or were you always writing along the way?
I was always writing. Right. And like other writers, I was getting rejected. I published short stories. I won a novella contest. But I put together 3 novels, and they got rejected. I had good agents. Things got rejected. And sometimes a story would get published. So it's not that I suddenly decided to write this book of short stories. Mm. I've been working over these stories 20 years, some of them, and correcting, changing, improving them along the way.
But to be published for the first time, at how old were you when it was published?
It was just published 2 weeks ago.
Right.
I'm 74.
74. I mean, that's an inspirational thing to anyone who is feeling that their work is unappreciated. Keep plugging away.
Hang in.
Yeah, hang in and keep the pressure on, because you never know. I mean...
But you have to get some encouragement along the way.
Of course
you do. I had encouragement. You have to get some things published here or there.
And you did.
And I did.
Yes.
So I think if no one ever publishes anything and you're going on after 60, 70 years, you have to think, what are you doing?
Yes.
But if you get any good hope, Yes, absolutely. Stick with it.
Did you want to call this collection Scary Old Sex?
I had this very good editor. I think she came up with the title. She said, no, I came up with the title. Now, it may just be that all of us are so scared of sex that we have to throw the title back and forth between us.
Is there anything in common between being a writer and being a psychoanalyst? What do you think?
That's a tough one. You're really doing very different things. As a writer, you are growing a character. You might start with a bit of sand, like an oyster, and then you have to accrete layers. You take a bit from this person you know, a bit from that person, then a whole lot from your imagination, and you want to fatten up and so that the reader has a sense of life, more life. As a psychoanalyst, you're presented with this whole confusing life that's been lived for a long time, and you've got to slim it down so that you can say something useful. You right. have to understand how what the person is coming in complaining they want help with is connected to how their childhood and to how they're relating to you.
None of the people you helped in psychoanalysis are going to recognize themselves in these stories, are they?
If they do, they've made it up.
Okay.
I would never write about a patient. It would be terribly unethical.
Okay, right. At the Happy Isles. Now, this is a story in your collection that I found. Well, you explain the scenario because this is a very elderly mother, 99, and she gets a visit from her daughter, who I think is in her late 60s.
68.
Yeah, okay. And the mother is still very much in control, and then something happens. Just explain what happens.
What happens is she loses control of her bowels.
Yeah.
And her daughter has to help her in the bathroom. It's a humiliation we all feel when I think there was a review done by Paul Bailey. He said about this particular story that even a fart can cause hours of discomfort, social discomfort. Mm. And the idea of a flood of incontinence, which this mother experiences, it bothers her terribly. And she's fighting to keep control all the time. She is alone with her daughter. It's not going on, at least in the middle of the dining room.
Nevertheless, though, it really tips the balance, doesn't it?
It does. It does tip the balance. There's a fight going on all through that story as to who's in control. And I think it ends up, I know it ends up, they go back to playing cards, which they were playing before.
But something's changed, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, before, the daughter was losing at the cards all the time. And she's even cheating, she was losing because her mother was that sharp. Afterwards, they go back to playing cards, and the mother wins one and the daughter wins one.
Arlene Heyman ending the live edition of the programme today, and she's still here, so we'll talk to her again in a second or two. Now, lots of you got in touch this morning. Thank you for that. Sandra says, Chloe, missing the point. Zoella is like a friend. She's not their entire world. From another listener, Nike, come to my taekwondo class and see the little girls with sparkly bows, pretty smiles, who kick ass, just lighten up. Right, fair enough. From Kat, please keep in mind that brands pay social influencers, should make that clear, thousands of pounds to be featured in their videos. From Claire, which of you are wearing makeup right now? Surely young girls emulate all the adults in their view. Well, Claire, yeah, I'm not actually, there should be a webcam in here, there isn't. I am wearing some slap. Admittedly, inadequately applied and not that much of it. But yes, of course, take your point. From Joanna, Zoella is an excellent role model, innovative, hardworking, honest and committed. Qualities we applaud. So why not in her case? Very good point. Anne-Marie, I have a 13-year-old daughter who's just growing out of Zoella. However, I would like to publicly thank her for being my daughter's inspiration and super role model in the field of beauty and healthy eating. I was never taught how to apply makeup as my mother didn't use it. I am 55. Young girls will always experiment with makeup, and isn't it better if they learn to use it properly and with a fresh, natural look that Zoe encourages? My daughter looks great with makeup and doesn't overuse it, thanks to Zoe, and encouraged by me. So let's not forget how she inspires girls too to eat healthily. Lots of you got in touch after our conversation with Eva Hamilton, the founder of the charity Key for Life. This is from Heather. As the mother of one of the few probation officers left in the system since the government privatised a big swathe of the service, I know how dedicated they are and want desperately to get reoffending figures down. If Cameron's serious about this, he would not have cut the probation service as he did, and he would now give the resources to deal with the issues which confront them. They are groaning under the weight of numbers and the complexity of the problems that each of their customers bring. I know how much my own son would like to do, but he can't. I also know how stressful this job is. And this from Jonathan. Dissing probation officers is easy. Governments have undermined this service so much. That's why it's not joined up. Jonathan, thank you for that. And from Linda, I applaud the stepped approach to rehabilitation that this charity is producing. But why is it necessary to do down the public sector, in this case the probation service, to promote a charity's work? Thanks for all your thoughts on that. And it was an interesting programme today, lots of variety. Now, still with me, the extremely patient author of Scary Old Sex. I mean, you know exactly what you're doing, calling a book Scary Old Sex, but you claim that wasn't your idea.
Well, my editor says it was my idea.
Okay, yeah, right. But it's a great idea, nevertheless. There was one story that we didn't get around to talking about, and I wanted to talk about it. Bear with me. This is the one about, it's called In Love with Murray, mm-hmm. and this is in memory of a man I studied at university. Just to tell the listeners who this is in memory of.
Bernard Malamud.
The great American author. Now, what is your connection to him?
I was at Bennington College. I was in my junior year when he came there to teach. And he continued teaching there for, I think, the next 30 years, the rest of his life. I was his student, and I had an affair with him, which was a very intense, full of literature, museums, everything.
You were very young, and he was...
I was 19, he was 47.
Right.
And the affair ended after 2 years, but we were then friends for the rest of his life. He died, I think, 25 years later. We were in touch weekly during that time, and when he died... there's a wonderful biography of Bernard Malamud by Philip Davis, who's an Englishman.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, and it's written in his biography, that on Byrne's desk was a letter to me and an article that I had given him. It was a psychoanalytic article about adults whose parents died when the adult was a child, and the impact of that. And Byrne's mother died, I think he was 14 or 15. And he evidently had written to me, I feel as if a door has opened on a room I wasn't meant to see.
Gosh. That's quite something, isn't it?
Yes. The impact of losing a parent in childhood is strong, and one doesn't understand all the ramifications.
No, I know that there are, the theory is that it can lead to enormous success in life, can't it? Losing a parent relatively young. I mean, obviously not in every case, and it doesn't mean it's easy. But am I right in thinking it can sometimes lead to achievement later in life?
Anything can lead to anything. I have...
Oh, you're such a... That's very clever. That's a clever answer. Expand. Go on.
Well, a human being is so complex that take an incident and there, if that same incident happens to 50 people, each one bears up under it differently.
Yeah.
So it is possible that losing a parent in early life might lead one to success, but I don't know what would be the mechanism of that. I've never had a patient to whom... Actually, I lost my first husband when I lost him. I didn't misplace him someplace. He died.
Yes, let's bang the euphemisms away.
Right,
but
exactly.
It's interesting that even you resort to them.
Oh, I can't bear when people talk about he struggled with cancer. He fought a brave fight. What is this nonsense? So there I am saying I lost my husband. Good God. At least I didn't say he passed away. Where did they pass to? Where did they go?
Don't ask me.
Yeah. But so I had two sons at that point. One was 12 and one was 16. And they are doing, as we say, knock wood. Let us go back to our peasant origins. They're doing well, but I don't think I would lay it to the fact of his death at all. So I don't know how that happens. That people are successful because of the death of a parent. I mean, they usually suffer. It's a terrible blow. And it's, depending on the age, your development is skewed. To lose a mother at 5 has devastating consequences. It doesn't mean you're automatically done in.
No.
But it's a blow.
It is going to change you, isn't it?
And
of course.
Yeah, and you'll adapt around it in ways that are unimaginable. But once you adapt around it, if you see a psychoanalyst, psychotherapist, that person will help you see how you adapted around it. You don't even understand.
No. I mean, I've got to say, and I hope I don't offend people here, but in England, I think it's fair to say that psychoanalysis is still regarded as bit of a middle-class indulgence for people with too much time on their hands. Not always. It certainly isn't something that's routinely offered, and nor is it in America.
No. Insurance companies don't pay very well for that, I have a feeling you have a better shot here with the National Health Service to get some decent care. But as for it being a middle-class indulgence, I suppose you could say that a liberal arts education is a middle-class indulgence, right? Going to college altogether might be seen as a middle-class indulgence. But to study oneself, and you're not just doing this as an education, you come in with symptoms. People have symptoms that are crippling. And why should you not get some help with them? Why should that be put down as a middle-class indulgence?
You're still working, aren't you? As a writer and doing the analysis as well.
Yes, and I hope to go on, because one only gets better with age until I lose my marbles. And when I lose them, I won't be able to write and I won't be able to see patients. But I'm a much better analyst now than I was 30 or 40 years ago. No one should see anybody under 50 if they can help it.
Really?
Yeah, because you know so much more. Now, of course, you have to see people under 50. They have to learn. You don't have money to pay for somebody who's more experienced. But if you keep getting analyzed yourself as an analyst, and you read more and you know the world better, so you just get better. And as a writer, it helps a lot in my book, Scary Old Sex, that some of those stories I have been working on for 20 years. I mean, not continuously. No. I've been doing other things, making love with my husband and so forth. But the stories have been worked and reworked. And even yesterday, I was interviewed by Irma Kurtz, the agony aunt.
Yeah.
And I learned something about that story you're talking about, In Love with Murray, about Bernard Malamud, that I quite didn't realize, which is that the young woman is called by the widow of the older artist at the end of the story. She calls to say her husband dropped dead the night before. And Irma Kurtz said, well, that was unusual that she would call her. And then I realized that in my own life, Anne Malamud called me to tell me that her husband had died. But that was after a 25-year relationship during which I had saved his life. He was having a heart attack and I got him to a hospital. She had to appreciate that. We had a long relationship.
Well, clearly, she did appreciate it.
Yes, she did.
Yes.
In this story, the girl has a much shorter relationship. She has one of 3 or 4 years. And while it might be unlikely that the widow would call, still, she was presented to the widow in the story as his student, and she was over there for dinner quite a bit. So it's not completely out of left field that the widow would call. She would call. She didn't know about the affair in the story, but she might call people who had been close to the husband. So.
Really interesting. I could listen to you all day, Arlene, but thank you very much indeed for that. I do recommend this collection of stories, Scary Old Sex by Arlene Heyman. You're still working and you're still writing, and more power to your both your elbows, if that makes any sense. Anyway, that translates into American English, but I've done my best. Tomorrow on the programme, Jess Glynn is performing live, which I'm looking forward to. And we talk to two of the young stars from the Channel 4 series Born to be Different. I don't know if, perhaps like me, you've been following this right from the start, back in 2000, I think it started. It's just a brilliant series, and they are really engaging young women, and they're on the programme tomorrow. Join me then for the programme and the podcast.